This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك ربك سريع العقاب وإنه لغفور رحيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
At our top stories this hour, U.S. President Joe Biden accuses Russia of weighing the use of biological and chemical weapons in its military operation in Ukraine. Ukraine's President Zelensky says any compromises with Russia to end the conflict must be put to a national referendum. Also, Iran's leader advises against tying the economy to U.S. sanctions and says national policies indicate progress can be made despite all restrictions. Thank you for joining us. U.S. President Joe Biden once again accusing Russia of considering the use of chemical weapons in Ukraine. Biden says President Vladimir Putin's back is against the wall. According to the U.S. president, Russia is now setting up false flags in preparation for using chemical weapons. Biden says these include Moscow's allegation that Kiev has biological and chemical weapons, but has not offered any proof to back his claims. Moscow says it has evidence of Washington helping Ukraine make chemical weapons in biowarfare labs near the Russian border. But the U.S. denies that. In order to discuss that story further, I'm now joined by Barry Grossman. He is an international lawyer and a political analyst joining us from Bali. Barry, welcome. Thank you for being with us. So the U.S. appears to be playing this same game over and over again, accusing Russia of carrying out false flag operations. What's your take on this latest claim by Joe Biden?
Well, you took the words out of my mouth. They've almost developed it into a sort of algorithm. The main difference between what is unfolding now in the Ukraine and what took place in Syria being that the speechwriters for Biden are a little bit more clever in that they're saying in advance that they're anticipating a false flag, which in fact the Russian, it's a sort of double false flag scenario, all of which is nonsense, as is the notion that the Russians have their back against the wall. They've been executing a very limited military operation with very key objectives in mind. It's not like all of the Ukraine is caught up in some kind of a conflagration of war. The Russians can turn up the heat. They don't need to resort to things like chemical weapons. And if we look at recent history, it's in fact the United States and its allies, including Iraq, that use chemical weapons, and Israel for that matter. There's no evidence that Russia has any intention to use chemical weapons, and there's no need, and it certainly wouldn't help Russia's position in the slightest. The idea that somehow Mr. Biden, President Biden, has a crystal ball and can see what the Russian high command is thinking and advising the president to do is really quite absurd. If they have intel, they should put it on the table, which of course they won't and they never do. And it's really quite absurd for the Americans to expect the Russians to put their intel on the table, evidencing the claim that Americans are producing chemical weapons in these various biolabs that they've established in the Ukraine. As things stand, we're moving forward. But really nothing that Joe Biden says can be taken as coming from Joe Biden, at least with President Zelensky when he was still a comedian. I assume he mostly wrote his own material. That cannot be said for Joe Biden. Joe Biden reads from a teleprompter, and he says whatever the teleprompter tells him to say. And this time he seems to have missed the mark entirely, although if there is anything to be concerned about, it's the possibility that this claim foreshadows an intention on the part of the Americans and the usual suspects now, including the Ukraine, to stage a false flag using chemical weapons and blame Russia.
Mm-hmm. And Barry, one more thing. This comment comes after Victoria Nuland, the Undersecretary of State, at least implicitly admitted the existence of U.S. biolabs in Ukraine, saying that the U.S. will do its utmost to make sure that the materials, off the biological research do not fall into the Russian forces. What is your opinion? I mean, admitting that the U.S. has some biolabs in Ukraine and then denying it, I don't understand this contradiction.
Well, I don't think anyone seriously contests that the Americans have established biolabs in the Ukraine, even if they're inconsistent about admitting their existence. The bone of contention they maintain is what those biolabs are being used for. So the Americans would have us believe that they're being used to develop, you know, medicines and other things necessary, for public health care and for vaccines and the like. And I personally am very skeptical of claims like that. It certainly beggars belief that that's something that would be more appropriately done in an almost lawless place like the Ukraine, rather than at home in the United States. Moreover, we've seen in the past that the United States makes no bones about supplying all manner of weapons, including chemical weapons, to their allies, as was the case in Iraq, when the U.S. wanted Iraq to go to war against Iran. And we also see claims now that the Ukraine military is using cluster bombs in the Donbass. And obviously they're coming from somewhere. So I tend to assume that whatever the U.S. political and higher end security apparatus say publicly is actually the opposite of what's true. Mm-hmm. Until we see evidence to the contrary that lends legitimacy to their claims. And frankly, this smells like a big dirty rat. And my biggest concern would be the U.S. and its allies repeating in the Ukraine what they did in Syria when they found they couldn't get the momentum that they wanted. And clearly in the Ukraine, they're also not able to get the momentum that they want. The idea that this is something that's going to end quickly seems far out of reach now, especially since President Zelensky is taking the absurd position that military strategy and the willingness to negotiate a peaceful outcome is something that has to be decided by referendum. That's never happened anywhere in the history of warfare and the history of armed conflict. The idea that some kind of a ceasefire and political compromise is put to the people in the form of a referendum. And if you want to talk about a referendum in the Ukraine, you come square up against that problem, which is that there's substantial parts of its claimed territory where the population is predominantly Russian.
Let me jump in and ask you one more question before I let you go. Can we compare what is happening now or the claims that are being made by the U.S. With regard to Ukraine and the conflict there with what happened in Syria when the war broke out? Because there were numerous claims made by the U.S. that the Syrian government at the time was using chemical weapons, but the OPCW, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, rejected so many of those claims.
Well, yeah, I mean, in essence, that's what I was saying. I probably should say it more clearly. Mm-hmm. The Americans seem to have developed this approach to an algorithm after what took place in Syria. And I see this going down the same path where, unable to achieve their objectives in the short term, they're going to start resorting to false flags, using chemical weapons, for example, and who knows what else, in order to blame the Russians and win the popularity contest internationally. And they're already pouring unprecedented resources into pushing this agenda to convince the public that Ukrainians are all victims and they're all the good guys and the Russians are the bad guys, and that this was a sort of hostile belligerent act by Russia, when in fact what we see happening now is almost an inevitable consequence of everything the Americans have done in the Ukraine, going back almost a decade, if not longer.
Barry, thank you so much for joining us. That was Barry Grossman, an international lawyer and a political analyst, joining us from Bali. The Ukrainian president has called on European leaders to cease all trade with Russia to pressure Moscow into halting its nearly month-long military offensive against his country. Volodymyr Zelensky pleaded with the Europeans not to sponsor Russia's weapons of war. Elsewhere, Zelensky said any compromises agreed with Russia to end the conflict must be put to Ukrainians' vote in a referendum. Zelensky once again insisted on meeting with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, saying the meeting was necessary to end the conflict. The Ukrainian defense minister also said Russia is conducting state terrorism in Ukraine and will go on to attack other countries. The UN says nearly 3.5 million Ukrainians have fled the country since the beginning of Russia's offensive on November the 24th. Meanwhile, a Russian court on Monday banned Facebook and Instagram, labeling their parent company Meta an extremist organization. The two social media giants are already banned in Russia. The EU takes a major step forward in establishing its own army against the backdrop of the conflict in Ukraine. EU foreign and defense ministers have adopted the so-called strategic compass, which will involve a huge increase in military spending.
At present, the 27 nations in the European Union spend 1.5% of their economic output on weapons and troops. That is about to increase significantly because EU ministers meeting in Brussels have just adopted their strategic compass following 2 years of negotiations.
Today, the military expenditure in Europe of all member states adding up, it's about 200,000 million euros. We have to spend more.
In his press conference, Borrell highlighted that combined EU nations already spend four times more than Russia on military capabilities. But that is still not enough, he said. He insists the bloc's military plan will not undermine NATO. Many analysts say there's no doubt that it will. But that's not a bad thing, as NATO is driven by an aggressive US foreign policy, they suggest. Foreign and defense ministers are in the process of creating an EU army. They say the conflict in Ukraine proves the importance of such a move. When opinion polls are carried out, most citizens always agree they don't want more money being spent on war machines.
The more we put and focus energy on something wrong like war, you know, it increases the chance that war is coming to us.
I just think it's to make the people feel safe, but I don't really think it will change anything, so I think they should spend money on something different.
There is also resistance to the huge amounts of money being spent by the 30 countries that make up the NATO military alliance.
my party and my political friends, we want that Germany goes out of NATO. We want to bring Russia into Europe because Russia is a part of Europe and the United States are far from Europe.
NATO and EU leaders will hold summits later this week here in the Belgian capital. Peace activists are calling for greater diplomatic efforts by them to end the bloodshed in Ukraine. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, once again stresses that the country's economy should not be tied to U.S. sanctions. Ayatollah Khamenei said while the sanctions removal should be sought, the country must be run in a way that restrictions cannot harm its economy. The leader said national production is an important factor, too. Plus, he added domestic economy should be knowledge-based. Ayatollah Khamenei was addressing the Iranian nation on the occasion of the Persian New Year. The leader also touched upon the Ukraine conflict and how it revealed what he called the blatant racism rampant in the West. He criticized Western countries for their double standards in dealing with white and black refugees. Ayatollah Khamenei also slammed the West for blackmailing independent countries by exploiting the concept of human rights. Kevin Barrett is an author and Middle East expert who says Iran's efforts to have a resistant economy have been successful and explains why the country has chosen such policy.
The Iranian economy has survived the most brutal long-range series of sanctions ever, although just in the past month or so, it's been eclipsed by the even harsher sanctions on Russia, but of course those have only been in effect for a few weeks. And Iran's been suffering under various forms of sanctions essentially ever since the Islamic Republic was created in 1979. Well, the sanctions on Iran have failed. In some respects, of course, they have inflicted terrible suffering on some people in Iran by keeping out needed medicines, things like that. But they've also acted as tariffs, and they've encouraged Iran to develop its own industries. And Iran has had rather astonishing success at that, given the unending economic and even terroristic hostilities directed against it. So I think the leader is on the right track by saying that it would be nice to end the sanctions, but it's also critically important for Iran to remain on this track of a resistance economy that can continue to thrive even with sanctions, because the Americans, as Putin has said, are non-agreement capable, as we saw when the Obama's deal on the JCPOA was trashed by the Trump administration, and now Biden wants it back.
It's been almost a year since negotiations to revive the 2015 Iran deal started in Vienna. Now the United States says it's ready to make difficult decisions to return Iran's nuclear program to limits that have been set out in the landmark accord. State Department spokesman Ned Price says one of the remaining issues for the U.S. is Iran committing to verifiable limits on its nuclear activities in return for an easing of sanctions. Price said the agreement is neither imminent nor close and that Washington is preparing equally for scenarios with and without a mutual return to the deal. Tehran is demanding the removal of U.S. sanctions in a verifiable manner, as well as guarantees that any possible agreement will ensure sustained economic benefits for the country. Senior Iranian cleric Ayatollah Mohammad Mohammadi Reishahri has passed away at the age of 76. Ayatollah Reishahri had been hospitalized in Tehran in recent days due to an illness. He was the first Iranian intelligence minister after the 1979 Islamic Revolution. He also served as prosecutor general as well as a member of the Assembly of Experts for two terms. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has in a message offered his condolences on the passing of the cleric. A charity organization has found a, quote, shocking trend of people of color paying a lot more for car insurance in the UK. It says they are paying hundreds of pounds more in premiums than white customers. Citizens Advice says its year-long investigation has uncovered that, on average, people of color are paying at least £250 more than white people to insure their vehicles. It says a so-called ethnicity penalty is up to £950 in some locations. The charity said in some areas the difference in price was more than 100%. It said the difference cannot be accounted for by common risk factors, such as crime rates and deprivation levels. The charity urged an investigation into the issue. However, the UK's main insurance industry trade body disputed the report's conclusions saying insurers never use ethnicity as a factor when setting prices. That's a wrap for this hour's World News.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the Name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence. in the limelight.
Natural variability is probably the cause, although global warming could have a role, says Tosin Thompson, writer, on the issue of low Antarctic sea ice in an article published under the heading Antarctic Sea Ice Hits Lowest Minimum on Record. Here's the story. Antarctic sea ice shrank to below 2 million square kilometers this year, the lowest minimum extent since satellite records began 43 years ago. The minimum extent of 1.92 million square kilometers occurred on February 25th and was 190,000 square kilometers less than the now second lowest extent reached in 2017, the U.S. National Snow and Ice Data Center reported on March 8. Ryan Foggett, a climatologist at Ohio University in Athens, said the record low for total Antarctic sea ice happened in much the same way as the 2017 event. Both events had an earlier-than-average maximum sea ice extent, which was followed by rapid declines, he says. From 2017, the sea ice extent stayed well below average for a few years, returning to near-average conditions again in 2020. The record low was partly due to strong winds pushing ice out of the Ross Sea, a bay off the coast of Antarctica, to areas further north where it is warmer. There, the ice broke up and melted, says Walt Mayer, a senior research scientist at NSIDC, who is based at the University of Colorado Boulder. Mayer says, I think much, if not all, of the event can be ascribed to natural variability. Unlike in the Arctic, where sea ice has declined rapidly since satellite measurements began in 1979, Antarctic sea ice has seen a lot of year-to-year variability. Contradicting expectations from some climate models that predicted it should decline in response to increased greenhouse gas emissions, the highest and second highest Antarctic sea ice minimums on record were reached in 2008 and 2013. In 2015 and 2016, the minimum dropped dramatically. With so much variability, it is not too surprising that one could get a record low, says Mayer. In Antarctica, sea ice will grow wherever it is cold enough for ice to form. Foggett says there are no land barriers in the way. Without barriers, the ice becomes much thinner, meaning it can be moved freely by the winds, covering a greater area, he adds. Antarctic sea ice responds to the whim of the atmosphere and ocean, says Pat Langhorn, who studies such ice at the University of Otago in New Zealand. This includes wind direction and ocean swells, as well as patterns in the tropical Pacific Ocean related to El Nino and La Nina. Mayer says the isolation of Antarctica has so far protected much of it from experiencing warming, with the exception of the Antarctic Peninsula, which sticks up to the north and has warmed markedly in the past 40 years. Global warming could have a role in this new record, but it is too early to tell, he says. This could be the start of sustained loss of Antarctic ice, similar to what we have seen in the Arctic over the past 50 years. Or it could be short-term variability that reverts back to the mean year, says Zach Haas' father, a climate scientist at Berkeley Earth in California. In the long term, climate change will result in declining Antarctic sea ice, he adds. Felicitations at the beginning of a new Iranian year, Nowruz. Congratulations to everyone at the start of spring and revival of nature. Palestine declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. The music industry is at the forefront of the campaigns to boycott the Zionist state. As the impact of the cultural boycotts bites deeper, the Zionist lobby has gone to great lengths to marginalise all expressions of support for the Palestinian cause. In a moment, I'll be speaking to an investigative journalist and to David Miller to find out more. But first, let's hear from Bianca Rahimi with this special report about Universal, the largest music company in the world, and its involvement in lobbying for Zionism.
What words come to your mind when you look at these musicians? Powerful, brave, rebellious? All have one thing in common. They are signed to a record label ran by individuals integral to the Israel lobby's cultural war against solidarity with Palestinians. The record label Universal Music Group is the world's largest music company. The CEO, Lucian Grange, pictured here at a Friends of the Israeli Defense Forces fundraiser, heads a company with significant power. His wife, Caroline Grange, funds the Zionist Federation and the Conservative Party. Billionaire Chaim Saban also has his own subsidiary through Universal and is known to be one of the largest donors to the Friends of the IOF in the organization's history. The infamous Lord Levy also worked as a financial consultant to Universal, simultaneous to fundraising for former Israeli Prime Minister and close friend Ehud Barak. However, the most important Israel lobbyist to emerge out of Universal Music Group is probably David Renzer, former CEO of Universal Publishing. Renzer, along with other well-placed figures in the music and film industry, started an organization by the name of Creative Community for Peace. The name sounds innocent enough, right? Well, examining the legal documents on its founding, we see that it was part of one entity called Israeli Emergency Alliance with the infamous arm of the Israeli state Stand With Us. Stand With Us works closely with the Israeli Foreign Ministry and has in recent years obtained funding directly from the Israeli Prime Minister's office. You can see why Creative Community for Peace would use the word peace to obfuscate its intentions. As Stand With Us have said, always include the word peace in your answer. If the Israeli side says peace more times than the Palestinian side says peace, we will win the PR war. Despite their best efforts, the CCFP have not been able to live down their relationship with Stand With Us, the founder claiming there is no day-to-day relationship with it. However, that is hard to believe when they were legally the same entity, shared the same office address and board members, and the founder, Dave Renzer, is in fact married to Esther Renzer, the founder and president of Stand With Us. CCFP take credit for lobbying stars like Alicia Keys and Macy Gray to perform in Israel following BDS campaigns asking to pull out in solidarity with the Palestinians. These operations included the mobilization of Israeli government figures. One of the organization's ambassadors is Ziggy Marley, son of late great political firebrand Bob Marley. They claim to have engaged with over 100 artists and boast over 50 leading executives in music, TV and film on their advisory board. The CCFP coordinates with the Israeli consulate in Los Angeles, and the former consul general there, David Segal, was full of praise for the organization. They are effective because they work from inside the industry. We're talking about artists that are used to having everyone love them, and now they are getting hate mail and petitions. That's why the best way to talk with them is from within the industry. This is just one example we know about. What else has the Israeli lobby group done behind the scenes to not only encourage support among celebrities for Israeli crimes, but blacklist those who choose to speak out? Can we expect any major artists supporting BDS to be signed up by Universal Music anytime soon?
We're joined down the line today from Glasgow by the investigative journalist Alan McLeod. Alan's a senior staff writer for Mint Press News and is the author of two books on fake news, misreporting and propaganda. Joining me in the studio, as usual, is our resident expert David Miller. David is an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog initiative, Spinwatch. Alan, can I come to you first, if we can get you up on the screen? You've written about the so-called Creative Community for Peace initiative. What is it? Who's involved? And what does it do exactly?
Sure. Well, Creative Community for Peace was created in 2011. Its founder was David Renser, as you said in your introduction, and it basically lobbies on behalf of the Israeli government to try to push a more Israel-friendly version of music and the creative industries more generally. It came into a lot of the headlines recently during the Sydney Festival. In January, the Sydney Festival is Australia's largest cultural event on the calendar. And the Israeli government actually sponsored the Sydney Festival, which prompted a lot of grassroots organizers to try to boycott the event. And in fact, well over 40% of the acts at the Sydney Festival in the end pulled out because of this controversial funding. This was where a Creative Community for Peace came in. They organized to try to block the BDS event spreading. And what they did was they released this letter that said, you know, BDS is wrong. The way in which these artists are representing the Israel-Palestine conflict is completely incorrect. They're you know, demonizing Israel. And they got a huge amount of record industry executives and people in the film and television world also to sign on to this. It really was a who's who of the record industry. So ultimately, we had this situation where there was a sort of bottom-up pressure to pull out of the Sydney Festival, and there was a top-down pressure from Creative Community for Peace to stay in, of course. You know, they talk about peace a lot, but it seems that, to be honest, their interests are more in just promoting the status quo with what's going on in Israel and Palestine right now. They talk about the need for dialogue and certainly the need to shun boycotting and divesting. But of course, if you are calling for dialogue, that immediately eliminates one of the fundamental tenets of BDS, which is they don't want to engage with the Israeli government on this issue. And so really, we could interpret the CCFP's statement on the Sydney Festival as a threat to everybody in the music industry, everybody in the creative world, that if you continue to support BDS, you're going to be shunned and it's going to be very difficult for you to progress in the world of film or television or music.
Yeah, I mean, David, I mean, that one's been quite a comprehensive answer there, but I just wondered, you know, what your thoughts were in terms of the implications for the music industry more broadly. And would you say that artists are effectively being coerced into silence on Palestine?
It very much looks that way. I mean, when you look at the signatures on that letter, as Alan says, a panoply of who's who of the music industry. And when you look at that, you are seeing in front of you effectively a Zionist stranglehold over the top of the music industry. And many of the artists who are signed by these large companies, Universal is the biggest, there are many other large companies, are artists who would instinctively be anti-racist, who would be pro-Palestinian. But their ability to actually either say such things, given their contractual situations, or even to be signed up in the first place, is extremely limited as a result of this. This is a really serious issue. The industry is supposed to be there to make money. It's supposed to be a capitalist-run venture. And you know that, of course, has its problems. But we're also seeing a very direct and strong political pressure from the top, with very strong Zionist sympathies for many of the people who are executive and ownership level in the industry. And that's really quite shocking for people who perhaps didn't realize this. And of course, the effects on black artists, on Muslim artists, and indeed all those who favor human rights and the liberation of Palestine is quite significant. And we simply don't hear these stories. I've anecdotally heard lots of stories of people who've been either shunned from contracts or have had contracts offered and then withdrawn as a result of their making statements in favor of BDS or in support of the Palestinians. So this is a really very serious issue. And it's like we've seen in past issues of the show, in many other areas of society, there is this extraordinary Zionist stranglehold at the top of industries and governmental organizations, which people don't really know enough about, I think.
Yeah. I mean, Alan, I wonder if I could ask you about the CCFP's relationship with the right-wing organisation Stand With Us, which it likes to play down. I mean, what exactly is the relationship and why is it controversial?
Well, those two organisations were very close to being the same one, and it's in the CCFP's nascent era. For years, if you wanted to donate to Creative Community for Peace, you had to do it through Stand With Us. And of course, Creative Community for Peace's founder, David Renzer, his wife is Esther Renzer, who is one of the co-founders of Stand With Us. So we've got this very close relationship between these groups. And actually, you find this very often with a lot of these pro-Israel organizations. It tends to be the same faces, similar sources of funding, and generally pushing the same sort of voice. I think the idea is really to try to produce a sort of sense that there is a large community of people all saying roughly the same thing. But in fact, when you look at it, it tends to be just sort of different arms of the same broad organization here.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if I could maybe turn to you then, David, and just ask about the CCFP's relatively long reach, doesn't it seem to have? 200 Hollywood stars lent their signature to a petition in response to Israel's attack in 2014, the Protective Edge Initiative, as it was so called, and they lobbied for Israel hosting the Eurovision Song Contest. And they even penned a letter last year about the bombardment of Gaza, complaining about inflammatory one-sided coverage. I mean, you know, what's the implication of all this? I mean, you know, what's going on here? I mean,
what's going on? I mean, as Alan said rightly, this was the same organisation as Stand With Us from the beginning. Stand With Us, let's remember, is not just any old AstroTurf pro-Israel organisation. It's an organisation which was set up, it's reported, on the initiative of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and has been very core to the activities of the Ministry of Strategic Affairs since it took on the anti-BDS responsibility in 2015 under Minister Gilad Erdan. It was involved in all of the Ministry of Strategic Affairs conferences held in Tel Aviv and in Jerusalem, where they brought all sorts of people from across civil society who would support Israel's abuses. And Stand With Us was central to that. So it's effectively an arm of the Israeli state. The ministers of the Zionist regime have said, you know, that they use it for force projection. It's an actual sort of arm's length body for the Zionist regime itself. So let's not be beat about the bush here. This is an asset of the government in the Zionist regime. And so that's what this is for. Its function, the Creative Community for Peace, is to dissuade people in the entertainment industry from voicing anti-racist and pro-Palestinian views. And it tries to do that by co-opting the people in the industry, all the stars, in not just in the music industry, but in film, in television, in literature. And of course, that's done through the managements of those artists. So many of the artists who are signed up will be signed up as a result of being managed by a particular company or a particular talent agency, and that will be the price of them being managed. It is a quid pro quo for them to continue to be managed by these organizations. Now, many of these organizations, it turns out, have Zionists at the top of them, who knew this, but that's the case. And this is the reason that we have so many people, the great and the good of Hollywood or of the music industry, because they're effectively constrained into this. It's not that they necessarily don't believe, so some of them will go along because they're committed, but really this is a constraint on their freedom to express their support for anti-racist causes, which they would normally do in any other case except for Palestine. So it's a real issue of the reach of large cultural industry corporations who are able to constrain the roster of artists on their books to voice views which they would otherwise run a mile from.
I mean, and Alan, you've said that public opinion seems to be shifting following the bombardment of Gaza last year. I wonder, why do you think that's happening, and what impact do you think that's having on the CCFP?
Well, it's a very long and slow process. Generally, I think the rise of the internet and social media has been able to break the lock that corporate media has over the means of communication. Everybody and their cousin has a cell phone in their pocket. Everybody can become their own producer, can create videos and, you know, show a different side of the story. And these sorts of images of Gaza are going viral all the time. And so that's helping a new generation kind of see the conflict in a different light. Another thing is, particularly in the United States, American Jews tend to be very liberal, tend to be very left-wing, and Israel has generally been sort of moving rightwards for quite some time now. And so particularly the younger generation of American Jews are a little bit disillusioned with where Israel is going. Added to that has been work of great scholars who have refused to give up on this issue. And so I think just a confluence of many different little things have generally turned the tide towards a more sort of sympathetic view of the Palestinians. Of course, in the Global South, that's always been the case. But in the United States, it's starting to change as well. The implications of this could be quite substantial down the road. We have to see where it goes. But certainly for people who want to see Palestinian liberation, the signs tend to be pretty good right now.
Mm. I mean, David, Alan mentioned in response to the first question about the Sydney Festival and the impact of that. I mean, what do you think the significance is of that? And, what role, if any, did Stand With Us play at that time?
Well, Stand With Us didn't previously organise in Australia, and it was Sydney which thrust it into organising there from afar, and it's now going to launch its own operation in Australia. So that's a sign that then there's a new front for them to fight, which is in Australia, which is good. The more fronts that there are for them to fight on, the better. And of course, they will put lots and lots of resources into this, and they will try their best to beat it back. But if I can take viewers back to a similar kind of incident that happened in the UK in 2014, just at the time when Israel was attacking Gaza, which was the boycott of the Tricycle Theatre in London. Now, that was boycotted by a number of Zionist groups created for the purpose in order that the theatre would send back a grant that they got from the Israeli embassy. Now, the theatre had already agreed that they would cover the shortfall from the Israeli embassy. They sent the money back to the Israeli embassy, but the protesters wanted the whole thing shut down, and they succeeded in getting the whole thing shut down. So they won in that case. And that's a very close parallel to the Sydney Festival, where on the contrary, what happened was the artists in Sydney all pulled out and said, we're not going to participate in this festival if it's funded by the Israeli embassy. And they won that issue in a way which the Tricycle Theatre was a defeat. And this is, remember this is a defeat in 2014 before Jeremy Corbyn was elected in 2015 as the leader of the Labour Party here, and before the massive onslaught there was over anti-Semitism. So they were able back then to be really quite successful quite easily, and yet now in Sydney they're facing real resistance. So I think we see the trajectory. Alan says this is going slowly. It is going slowly, it's going far too slowly, but there will come a moment, there will come a tipping point where this becomes unstoppable. And we're building to that. BDS is building to an unstoppable momentum so that it will be impossible for the Israelis to put on these kinds of events, cultural festivals, to art wash or greenwash or whatever other kind of washing they are trying to do with events all around the world. So it's a sign of hope, I think, that Sydney has happened. It's a sign that they are feeling that they've got to open new fronts in Australia and other places. And it's a sign that we're coming to a moment, could be quite soon, where there's a tipping point, and Israel's money will be refused wherever it's offered.
Mm. I mean, Alan, a lot of stars seem to be have been appropriated in the sort of weaponization of anti-Semitism, and I know that you've written about J.K. Rowling as one example of that. I wonder if you could maybe say a bit about the J.K. Rowling case and just get your thoughts really on whether you feel that anti-Semitism is being used as a sort of political football.
Sure. So J.K. Rowling, if anyone doesn't know, one of the most beloved and richest writers in history, wrote the Harry Potter series. But really, from day one of that series, there were some pretty problematic portrayals, particularly of goblins, which used a lot of the anti-Semitic tropes that have been around for hundreds of years, depicting Jewish people as obsessed with money or subhuman. And these were really like baked into the Harry Potter series. This has constantly been talked about, but it went viral a few months ago when Jon Stewart spoke out about it, pretty much saying that it was clearly anti-Semitic. Interestingly, the organizations which went so hard after political figures like Jeremy Corbyn all rallied around J.K. Rowling, saying that she's a true friend of Israel, etc. And I think one of the reasons is that her politics has always been very pro-Israel. She is a centrist, Blairite supporter of the right wing of Labour. Not only that, her business partner, Neil Blair, who I think it's fair to say pretty much runs her life. He's the person in charge of her charity. He was a producer of a lot of her television adaptations. He's got all sorts of connections to her. He was very much involved in the Creative Community for Peace and other pro-Israel organizations. And so really, I think we do see a huge double standard here when somebody like J.K. Rowling can produce some of the most anti-Semitic caricatures that we've seen in decades in popular culture and get a free pass. But where somebody like Emma Watson posts a very anodyne message of peace, which can be interpreted as a pro-Palestinian, she is viciously attacked for being anti-Semitic. So I think your question when you said, is this a political football? I think it clearly is. I think this has not very much to do with anti-Semitism and much more to do about which these respective characters' positions on Israel and Palestine. So I think that's really what's going on here.
I mean, could you say anything about the Abraham initiatives and what the implication of that is?
Yeah, so Blair is an ambassador for the Abraham initiatives, which is a similar group that promotes cultural connections between Israel and the West. According to the organization's most recent annual report with the British Charities Commission, the Abraham Initiative's mission is to, quote, advance synergy between Israeli bodies, individuals, initiatives, and programs with respective agencies and institutions in the UK. So I think translating that into plain English, it means that their job is to try to amalgamate British government institutions or civil society institutions and really push this pro-Israel message there. The Abraham Initiatives is directly funded by the Israeli government and also by USAID, It's also sponsored by the State Department through the Middle East Partnership Initiative, and government cables released by WikiLeaks showed that the Middle East Partnership Initiative was actually the vehicle through which the US government actually sent money to jihadi groups in Syria. So, I mean, really, the underscoring point here is that the Abraham Initiative is a group that's, you know, intimately tied to the Israeli government and its nation-building project. And I think the fact that so many of its directors come from that milieu is something that we can really look at here. The co-executive director of the Abraham Initiatives, for instance, is a former spokesperson of the Israeli Ministry of Immigration and a director at the Jerusalem Foundation, which is a group which builds illegal settlements on Palestinian land. So this idea that the Abraham Initiatives is really about dialogue and peace, I think when you start looking at it, I think it's really about producing anodyne, soporific language, which kind of, whitewashes what's going on in Israel and Palestine right now.
We're going to have to leave it there, Alan. Thank you so much for your time, and to you, David. Really interesting discussion again. Thank you very much, and until next time on Palestine Declassified, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
In the limelight.
Most studies linking features in brain imaging to traits such as cognitive abilities are too small to be reliable, argues a controversial analysis. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Ewan Calloway, writer. This article is published under the heading "Can Brain Scans Reveal Behavior?" Bombshell study says not yet. Here's the story. In 2019, neuroscientist Scott Marek was asked to contribute a paper to a journal that focuses on child development. Previous studies had shown that differences in brain function between children were linked with performance in intelligence tests. So Marek decided to examine this trend in 2,000 kids. Brain imaging data sets had been swelling in size. To show that this growth was making studies more reliable, Marek, based at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri, and his colleagues split the data in two and ran the same analysis on each subset, expecting the results to match. Instead, they found the opposite. I was shocked. I thought it was going to look exactly the same in both sets, says Marek. Adding, I started out of my apartment window in depression, taking in what it meant for the field. Now, in a bombshell March 16th Nature study, Marek and his colleagues show that even large brain imaging studies, such as his, are still too small to reliably detect most links between brain function and behavior. As a result, the conclusions of most published brain-wide association studies, typically involving dozens to hundreds of participants, might be wrong. Such studies link variations in brain structure and activity to differences in cognitive ability, mental health, and other behavioral traits. For instance, numerous studies have identified brain anatomy, or activity patterns that studies say can distinguish people who have been diagnosed with depression from those who have not. Studies also often seek biomarkers for behavioral traits. There is a lot of investigators who have committed their careers to doing the kind of science that this paper says is basically junk, says Russell Poldrack, a cognitive neuroscientist at the Stanford University in California, who was one of the paper's peer reviewers. It really forces a rethink. After his botched replication, Marek set out to understand the reasons for the failure, together with Nico Dosmech, a neuroscientist at WashU, and their colleagues. That work resulted in the latest study, in which they analyzed magnetic resonance imaging, that is MRI, brain scans, and behavioral data from 50,000 participants in several large brain imaging efforts, such as the UK Biobank's collection of brain scans. Some of these scans gauged aspects of brain structure, for instance, the size of a particular region. Others used a method called functional MRI, the measurement of brain activity while people do a task, such as memory recall or while at rest, to reveal how brain regions communicate. The researchers then used subsets drawn from these large databases to simulate billions of smaller studies. These analyses looked for associations between MRI scans and various cognitive, behavioral, and demographic traits in samples ranging from 25 people to more than 32,000. In simulated studies involving thousands of people, the researchers identified reliable correlations between brain structure and activity in particular regions and different behavioral traits, associations that they could replicate in different subsets of the data. However, these links tended to be much weaker than those typically reported by most other studies. Researchers measure correlation strength using a metric called R, for which a value of 1 means a perfect correlation and 0, none at all. The strongest reliable correlations Marek and Dosmech team found had an R of 16/10, and the median was 1/10. In published studies, R values above 16/10.